Welcome to Mandates and Megaphones, hosted by Jeremy Maggs. Unpacking the politics, promises, and power plays behind the G20 summit.
Hello and welcome to Mandates and Megaphones here on MoneyWeb in association with Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs. And as South Africa prepares to host the G20 summit a little later, global power, I think it's fair to say, is being renegotiated in real time. The old order is fracturing, new blocs are emerging, and Africa, for the first time, is perhaps sitting at the top table both as a participant but as a potential power broker. But opportunity in this multipolar world obviously comes with risk. The risk of being a bystander in this reshaped system that I've already referred to, rather than be a shaper of it. So let's try and read the geopolitical signals and maybe decode the economic implications, not only for the continent but also for South Africa. I'm in conversation with the chief economist at Standard Bank, Gulen Balam. A very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start the conversation with a broad look at the signals and the shift, if we can. As we move into this multipolar world that I've already referred to, how are you reading the current balance of power and where the continent fits in?
I think one would suggest maybe that this is a rare confluence of history and opportunity. The opportunity lies in the fact that Africa hosts this event, in South Africa in particular, at a time when there is this decided shift from the unipolar dominance of the early 1990s to a multipolarity, but a multipolarity that also has its fissures. In other words, we see strained transatlantic ties, but at the same time, attempts by the Global South to reinforce its cords.
The trouble, I would suggest, is that we are still, in many respects, and I'm referring to the continent, perceived as an observer in global governance. Do you think the G20, now just a matter of days away, is maybe a pivot to some degree of influence? And if you agree with that assertion, how much influence might the continent actually wield?
Jeremy, it's a legitimate question in the sense that we must, you know, argue as well that is the continent and South Africa's representation merely symbolic, or will there be this tangible opportunity for inserting the continent into global dialogue in a sustainable way? And there's probably two dimensions to this. One is Africa needs to strengthen its internal dynamics. And when I say internal dynamics here, I talk about, for example, its macroeconomy with respect to fiscal anchors, perhaps attempts to deepen capital markets, further enhancing of regional partnerships, and of course the African continental free trade comes to mind. So in other words, Africa needs to internally reform its macro structure as well as the political and regional trade dynamics. And against that backdrop, this idea of increasing alignment with other poles of influence, bearing in mind that Africa now trades almost evenly with all the blocs of the world, meaning the China-India bloc, the Middle East bloc, and then Europe and the United States. And of course, this multipolarity with, let me call it, evenness, gives the continent optionality. And this optionality, therefore, can be interpreted as power.
Let me come back to that phrase, internal dynamics. It's interesting. What I'm also maybe hearing you say, and maybe I'm being unfairly interpreting this, but maybe the continent needs to get its house in order before we start looking too far beyond the influence that we might wield. And I'd suggest to you, Gulam, that maybe we are stretching a little too far. Maybe we are just too far off the pace.
You're interpreting my remarks very, very precisely, Jeremy. So yes, I am saying that we need to get, as you colloquially put it, our house in order. We cannot be integrating into a global economy with domestic affairs that is clumsy and just unwieldy. I mean, one must bear in mind that even though we talk about Africa's GDP being about $3.5 trillion, it's still smaller than Germany alone. So to that regard, you know, Africa must recognize it needs to really strengthen this notion of morphing into one meaningful market rather than 50 odd plus markets. And hence my suggestion that while there is this reconfiguration of multipolarity and a challenge to the old order, simultaneously, Africa needs to build on its internal reform agenda. And even if this emerges firstly as regional strengths, in other words, a very strong East Africa bloc, an alternative substantial Southern Africa bloc, then we will have some momentum. So while the ultimate perhaps ambition is to have a unified Africa from the Maghreb to the Cape, I think this incremental shift towards some ambition of resilient regionalism will be very powerful alongside the sweeping shifts taking place in a global sense.
But the risk, of course, is the continent being drawn into the gravitational pull of competing global blocs, and that would preclude us maybe from charting our own coherent strategy.
The very fact that the old order is being reframed as a function of the very ascendancy of the global south, and perhaps led by the Asian nations, has generated a degree of discomfort with respect to the old commanders, the old authorities within this geopolitical dynamic. And of course, there is this uneasiness in terms of the old partners forsaking some level of authority, some level of power. And it was never going to be the case that there was this easy transition or pivot, as you put it, to a pragmatic, networked, and inclusive global order. It was always going to be fragmented and challenged by resistance to the old superpowers. And this is exactly what we are witnessing by an attempt to delegitimize the 2025 G20 under the auspices of South Africa.
Are there signals that you're picking up from the United States, China, and the EU about how seriously they're taking Africa's role? And I guess as far as the US is concerned, we can almost put a cross through that, given developments that have been announced recently that America just simply will not be participating at all.
Jeremy, just a few days ago, I engaged with one of South Africa's representatives to the United States. And I said we should always, in the framework of scenario analysis, be mindful of what the tail risk could be and prepare for it. And I referred to the tail risk as being the equivalent of a Munich moment. In other words, when J.D. Vance, the Deputy President of the United States, the Vice President, traveled to Munich in February for the Munich Security Conference, he delivered a very substantial message from the United States with regard to prospective relationships with Europe. And there were several outcomes, one of which, for example, was this lurch to increase defense spending by Europe, in addition to a variety of other diplomatic suggestions. And in this respect, I think we should have been mindful and prepared that the U.S., particularly given that it espouses under President Trump an ideology or values that differ somewhat with regard to the G20 of South Africa, which, as you know, is sustainability, equality, and solidarity. And those values that underpin the 2025 endeavor may be reframed when the U.S. adopts the G20 presidency from the 1st of December and through March of 2026. So this notion that the United States would easily embrace the pending meeting and subsequent communique was always going to be potentially in peril, and now we see that emerge. I think what we have to do is appreciate that, you know, let's call it a bifurcated multilateralism, where the United States espouses a particular view. Maybe some members of Europe will align with that. But I think we should look at this as a global north, perhaps with a wavering US embracing the global south, G20, and subsequent communique.
But how big a blow to South Africa's aspirations and the success of the G20 is the United States' decision? And do you think South Africa is responding assertively enough?
So it is certainly a hammer blow. The United States accounts for about one-fifth of global GDP. The United States is a technological marvel, and it will continue to be a very significant economy in global affairs, and its diplomacy, its international diplomacy, will matter. I don't think we can choose, and it would be unwise to associate ourselves with a dismissiveness of the United States. I think we should always attempt to find some level of chemistry, however difficult it appears, in respect of our affairs, African affairs and South African affairs with the United States. However, I agree with you fully that it is likely to remain as tacky as it has been. And a moment ago, you said, has South Africa been as assertive in terms of, you know, putting its position? And I'm not sure that an assertiveness can really help the United States and South Africa find each other. I mean, quite clearly, there's a commanding approach from the United States, led from the White House. And I think if we attempt to match it with a commanding retort, I think it is only going to result in further fragmentation. If anything, I mean, this is the art of diplomacy. And I think what we should be doing is, on the one hand, while countering the narratives emerging from the United States with facts, and facts that clearly speak differently to the type of narratives emerging out of the White House. But we should simultaneously bear in mind that this is not about facts. This is not about truth on the ground. And this is not so much about, you know, genuinely preserving our austerity or development policies. This is about America taking a view, and how do we engage with the United States to find some compromise ground, even if it means we forsake some of our, you know, sacred cows, but those sacred cows that maybe don't cost us too much. That's the art of diplomacy. Let me give you an example. If we were to recant, if the president, for example, says that he treats the song, and we know which song we're referring to, as an affront, and he would like to see that song subordinated because it doesn't enhance social chemistry about South Africa. I mean, is that a concession that is going to cost us enormously, either financially or reputationally? I would say probably not. But, you know, we don't need to recant, for example, on transformation policies where they're legitimate and genuinely empowering, for example. So I think we should choose within our toolkit our items for which we can make concessions with minimal cost and see how we can reestablish some association with the United States again.
Often difficult, though, Ghulam, to sell those concessions that we might have to make internally, given the robust nature of politics within South Africa.
Agreed. And that is where the president is called upon to be presidential. If we just decide we are going to harness this optionality that we think is maybe more supreme than it really is, it's substantial, and we will seek to sever ties with the United States and pivot to the East, to the Middle East, then I think, you know, we're going to find ourselves compromise over the medium to long term. I think while the White House certainly is shaping policy in the United States, and I draw distinction between the White House and Washington, for that matter, I think we must continue to engage and, again, cling to this idea that the art of diplomacy is being able to make concessions that limit the losses locally while maximize our attempts to infuse ourselves into this new global paradigm. We know also that, you know, it's deeply asymmetric. America can easily dispense with South Africa. There is no real need for the United States to be throwing its arms around South Africa. But reciprocally, I don't think South Africa can easily dismiss the United States as a diplomatic, a trade, and as a capital partner.
South Africa might be in the spotlight, Ghulam, as far as this is concerned, but this also tells us a lot, doesn't it, about the risks for middle power countries operating in this unpredictable multipolar world that we've been discussing.
You know, the idea of middle power is also potentially taking new shape. So, for instance, while you would regard the Middle East as a middle power, as a middle kingdom, I would argue that the Middle East is a superpower, for instance, with regard to capital. So the quantity of capital that seems available from the Middle East for African investment, liquidity, just simply the sheer volume of trade and the manner in which that's escalating. Also acknowledging that in terms of people mobility, and here I make reference to Emirates Airlines, the Middle East is significant on the continent, and also in terms of operating ports and therefore the toll booth through which goods transfer. Yeah, again, the Middle East is significant through both DP World and Abu Dhabi ports. So again, to reinforce this point, this idea of a Middle East middle power is a superpower with respect to its relations on the continent. And it's only indicative of the manner in which multilateralism is evolving and these new partners gives us optionality while attempting to, you know, perhaps dance to multiple tunes.
I want to pivot our conversation in just a moment to the economics and the opportunity of the G20, but just to wrap up the kind of the signals and the shift that we've been talking about, Ghulam, from a geopolitical standpoint, what then do you think success for South Africa is likely to look like when that final communique is signed, if in fact a communique can be developed?
Jeremy, I think going into the G20, one acknowledges that while the G20's strength is that in theory it houses 85% of global GDP, for years it has struggled to reach global consensus. And I think perhaps 2025 will represent perhaps an extreme in terms of attempting to reach that consensus. But having said that, the ambition of a G20 consensus was always going to be lofty. Hence my suggestion that if we are able to garner a consensus that embraces the remaining Global North members in the G20, combined with the Global South members, I think that will continue to just reinforce the multilateralism as fragmented as it is now. So in other words, I would argue, and this is not a defeat, it's a least cost approach given the fissures that the global economy is experiencing, while at the same time celebrating the strength and multilateralism of the Global South and friendly Global North partners.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Mandates and Megaphones. It's powered by Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs. I'm in conversation with Ghulam Ballam, who is Standard Bank's chief economist. And very broadly, we're talking about Africa's place in a multipolar G20 world. But Ghulam, let's focus now, as I said, on the economics and the opportunity emanating from this meeting. And how confident are you that the continent can translate its diplomatic visibility, this new diplomatic visibility, into some tangible economic gains, investment, trade, growth? Again, is that a very lofty aspiration, do you think?
No, Jeremy. I think it is not a lofty aspiration, and it is, in fact, within grasp. So we have to look at this ambition of African growth and African multilateral integration as a process rather than a moment in time, rather than just a 2025 ambition. And there's a few themes here that reinforce this capacity to achieve this ambition. One is that African growth is lively. African growth for the foreseeable future is likely to vacillate between 4 and 4.5%, maybe even 5% in some years. And even that minimum of 4% belies the fact that you will have very rapid growth on the eastern shelf of the continent, high single digits, and that 4%, which is a weighted average, is actually somewhat drawn down by the more sizable economies of South Africa, Nigeria, and Angola, which will likely grow for the foreseeable future in low single digits. So firstly, there is favorable momentum on the continent. Secondly, I think technology is currency. And here, the continent has been formidable. The continent has shown itself to house digital natives. Mobile banking, for instance, was born on the continent. And I think now with technological diffusion, what we're finding is elements and regions where the continent is moving beyond just leapfrogging to leadership with respect to how it melds information technology or modern technologies with data policy, energy security, and just general digital infrastructure. So I think these all provide very strengthened domestic capacities and potential. Then internationally, I think there's still clear recognition that Africa's 54 nations bring enormous diplomatic heft to multilateral fora, which is why China for more than two decades has been throwing its arms around the continent, which is why Europe also recognizes that it needs to have strong international diplomacy with the continent. So I think there is this almost organic capacity where the dominant and strengthened emerging markets, as well as historical developed nations, will continue to pursue Africa with zeal for Africa's potential. And then, of course, there is this notion of mining and metals, and particularly rare earth metals, where this will continue to put the continent at the forefront as global nations seek energy security and rare earth metal security. It'll automatically suggest that Africa has a seat at the international table.
Let me come back to tech very quickly then. Do you see a real role then that the G20 can play in driving global standards for tech and AI that will reflect developing world priorities? In other words, to make anything more tactile and relevant and usable for the continent that will then promote growth and development?
Jeremy, in the manner in which the current G20 led by South Africa is experiencing frictions with the United States, I foresee that when the United States hosts the G20 from December onwards, it too will probably encounter some level of frictions with the rest of the world, or at least key partners in the G20 framework next year. In other words, some of the themes and the frictions will persist and just take on new methods of diplomacy in which they are attempted to be resolved. That said, I think separate from what the G20 can achieve, and it's meaningful, there is a variety of other fora and mechanisms. And quite simply, the flow of people, capital, and labor, combined with goods and services, will continue to determine the shape of multilateralism. So put it this way, as opposed to a top-down geopolitical and political shaping of global relations, from a bottom-up perspective, we can talk about the manner in which the private sector and the manner in which the private sector, through, as I've suggested, capital, trade, and just people mobility, continues to shape partnerships and pursue new opportunities. That, I think, will continue to strengthen. And very last, I will just suggest that, you know, as a policy, irrespective of whether it is under the auspices of the G20 or other bilateral or multilateral fora, if we continue to pursue items such as energy access, logistics efficiencies, food security, and even green industrialization, I think those themes will remain the manner in which continued multilateral accords are established or recalibrated in the ensuing years.
We are recording this conversation on an unseasonably cold day in Johannesburg, and climate finance, Gulam, is set to dominate the agenda once again, or at least it will be displayed prominently. Do you have any kind of assessment on whether the promised capital flows are going to materialize, and if so, on what terms?
I do think this G20, particularly with its association with the B20, the Business 20, has moved the dial somewhat with regard to creating a more Africa-inclusive capital market, in other words, globally inclusive capital market. I think we've clearly led the agenda with regard to highlighting climate funding, debt relief, and also debt service costs. The G20 and B20 process has put rating agencies on notice with regard to their influence in shaping the so-called Africa risk premium and calling for more transparency and even more accuracy, and even maybe more spirited resolution by the rating agents with regard to their judgments of credit standing of various African countries. So I do think this will endure. And I think irrespective of what America seeks to do with regard to at least finance generally and climate finance in particular, as you highlight, along with debt relief and service costs, I think we've made progress that is irreversible. And I think if it was the ambition of translating South Africa's presence at the helm of the 2025 G20 into greater parity, then I think we've made some headway, but I think that headway will continue regardless of whether America holds the G20 next year or not. These themes have been embedded.
So let's finish with this. You've said in the past that multipolarity will reward countries with what you term as a clarity of purpose. Do you think that Africa has that clarity of purpose right now as we go into this big diplomatic event?
I suspect there is a growing clarity, and we frame this clarity within the ambition of what we call a geographic arc of prosperity. So we're suggesting that from Cape Town to the Middle East to the Far East, there is this arc of geopolitical alignment. There is a geography that houses at least two-thirds of humanity, that encompasses more than half of global GDP, and a geographic arc that has the potential for finding greater levels of solidarity, greater sense of celebrating social equalities, and just general purpose. So yes, I would argue that this clarity of with respect to how we operate in a fragmented world and continue to see pockets of strengthening multilateralism amidst the type of recasting that America is leading.
Gulam Balim, thank you very much indeed, Chief Economist at Standard Bank. I really do appreciate that. There's no doubt that Africa's emergence in a multipolar world is a moment of power and potentially a moment of peril as well. There's no doubt the risks are high. I guess the question is whether we can convert the influence that we've been talking about into some kind of tangible outcome and hopefully some kind of vision into real value. That's it for this edition of Mandates and Megaphones, brought to you by Standard Bank here on MoneyWeb. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Mandates and Megaphones. You can find more episodes on moneyweb.co.za.